We continue this sheet on Yibedah. Yibedah says there is a din that is called respect for food, meaning there is a sin for anybody committing the act of bizayon ochlin, to disgrace, disrespect food, is a very serious sin. The Gemara calls this the law of Ein Ma'avidin al Ha'ochlin. If ever you note the strange sight, you might see it among the very religious people. They're walking in the street and they see a piece of bread on the sidewalk. They will move it over to the side, but people will not step on it because it's disrespectful, sinful to step on food. Ein Ma'avidin al Ha'ochlin means you're not supposed to pass by food that's on the ground and to let it be disgraced. Well, this in addition to a general law, the Gemara, that respect for food means you're not allowed to throw food. This means food that is unprotected. Example, food that has a hard shell, let's say an orange, which has a protective covering, or any type of nuts, which are hard, those may be thrown. But any food that has no covering at all, especially bread, of all food, bread is the holiest, that is sinful to throw it, even if a person would be sure somebody else would catch it. The throwing itself is an act of disrespect to food. So, therefore, there's also a din, Tosafot says, this is a din of Shulchan Aruch, there's a custom that at a wedding they throw rice or other types of grain at the chatan and kara, bride and groom. This, the din says, is definitely forbidden because the rice falls on the floor and it's stepped on, unless you have hard nuts which are thrown. And that, of course, could maim or cripple the chatan and kara, unless you throw it lightly. But any type of food that is unprotected and is open, that is called a bizayon ochlin, a disrespect of food, and that's considered a very serious crime. We also mentioned previously, and this should be mentioned again and again, that the key, the bad key, the key to poverty, where the Gemara says the fastest way for a person to lose his wealth, to become poor, is to disrespect crumbs. When the person finishes eating and there are breadcrumbs on the table, he just brushes them off, or he lets crumbs fall on the floor where they're stepped on. This is a sin that is so bad. The punishment for it is poverty. A person who is very careful with crumbs, the slightest crumb, no matter what the size is, he's careful to see that he does not step on these crumbs. That person protects his wealth against the satan, because there is a special angel, a special bad angel that's appointed to attack, to punish those people who disregard the crumbs that fall to the floor. The Gemara tells of a case where a person was very careful, a man was very careful with crumbs. He never allowed a single crumb to fall on the ground. He always was careful to brush them up, clean them up, and throw them out where they couldn't be stepped on. And the satan continually lurked over this person, waiting to catch him. He was anxious to catch this person because the greater the person, the more these satan attacks. One day, this man went out in the garden, the field, and he ate food there. He ate bread, and the crumbs fell on the ground. The Gemara says the satan began to laugh. Now I have caught him. At the end of the meal, this man took a knife. He scraped up the grass, the earth around him, so he would be sure to get all the crumbs, put it into a bag, and disposed of it. The minister of the satan gave out a loud cry, said, "That's the end. I surrender. I give up on this person." But the lesson here is, the din Shulchan Aruch says, and the Zohar Kadosh especially speaks about this with a very strong warning. A person should be careful not to disregard this halacha, this din. A very serious item. Don't belittle an item because it's only a small crumb. This small crumb could contain a person's entire fortune. By being careful with it, a person could save his fortune and could become wealthy. by being negligent, allowing this crumb to fall, to discard it, to disregard it, person could actually lose his wealth because of that. So this is the din of respect for food. It is created by Hashem for the purpose of giving a person his nourishment. But Ezal says, what is so important about food? There are two items that are directly contrary to each other. One is the physical, the other is the spiritual. One is the guf, the body, the other is the neshama, the soul. There's no connection between the two. You don't find one actually contacting the other. Naturally, the neshama in a person's body gives him life. But you don't find a connection between the two. They're two separate items. A person dies, the neshama leaves. The body is still there. The one item that does make direct contact between body and soul is food. Person eats. That's what retains the soul in his body. If he would not eat, the soul would be forced to leave the body. Person could not live without food. So food is that important, and it keeps a person's neshama in his body, keeps a person's life continuing. Therefore, he should show a deep respect for food by not disgracing it, not showing disrespect for it in his actions. The Yemeni says there are three items that Talmidei Chachamim, the rabbis, usually do not tell the truth about. Though the word emet is so important, emet truth, is so important an item, and the word sheka, falsehood, is so serious a transgression, because the Yemeni says that the seal of a king is the symbol of a king. What is the chotam, the seal of Hashem? Emet, truth. Hashem Elokechem emet. Hashem, kaviyachol, cannot tolerate lies, cannot tolerate untruths. A person who tells a lie automatically estranges himself from Hashem. Hashem repels that person, removes him from his presence. He cannot be close to the Shekhinah. And yet the Gemara says there are exceptional cases, three cases where the rabbis specifically do not tell the truth, these three cases. Three cases are, one is Mesechta, that means Gemara. Second case is Puria. Puria means bed. Third case is Ushpiza. Ushpiza means an inn or a host. In these three cases, the rabbis do not tell the truth. One, the first case, the standard interpretation of this word means that if a person asks a Talmid Chacham, did you learn this specific Gemara? As a matter of humbleness, as a matter of modesty, the rabbi should say, I did not learn that Gemara. Because if he says he did, that's boasting. I learned this Gemara, that means he's saying, I am a very learned person, Talmid Chacham. Now, Tosafot asks, we also have a law which says that when a rabbi is asked the question, he should not hesitate. The question of learning, he shouldn't hesitate. He should specifically, clearly come out with the answer, which means he's asked a question about a certain law in a certain Gemara. He should come out and give a very clear answer. He cannot say, I don't know the law. That itself is against the law. He knows a certain din, he should elaborate on it, clarify it to the person asking him. So how can we say that if here it says the rabbi should say, I have not learned the Gemara? The answer is, Tosafot says that if he is asked a specific din, a halacha, a law, then he must answer it. But if he's asked just in general, did you cover this whole Gemara? He is supposed to say, I did not. Though it is an untruth, in this case it is permissible to avoid boasting. Second item, Puriya bed, means that if he's asked if he has slept in a certain bed, this doesn't mean the bed in his own home, then he tells a white lie, an untruth, and says, I did not. Because who knows who else might have slept in that bed? There might be something unclean there. It would put the rabbi in a bad light. So he is permitted to tell an untruth and say he did not sleep in that bed. Third case is that of the host, which means that if he was treated well, he was taken in as a guest by a host, and if others ask him, how are you treated, he may say it was not a good place to stay. Because if he says it was good and he compliments the host, it might bring an unwanted type of guests who would invite themselves to take advantage of that good-natured host. So in order to protect his host, who treated him so well, he's allowed to say, this is unusual too, he could say, speak badly about his host, or to put it in a light that's not complimentary. These are the three items. And there is a second type of interpretation for this. By the way, it's interesting to note that Masha says that the second item, the word puriya means bed. There is also the word puriya found in the Gemara language. Puriya is purim. The Gemara says that chayev adam, a person is required, the besume bepuriya, to become drunk on purim. It is compulsory for a person to drink enough wine to become drunk on Purim. So it's meant to become drunk. And the Gemara Megillah says, to what extent must he become drunk? Ad de lo yada, to the point where he is so inebriated, so intoxicated, that he has not known the difference between Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai. He doesn't know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. That's how befogged he becomes. So then we find the word puriya, purim. So the interpretation here is that a Talmid Chacham would like to avoid going into a semi-conscious state. It's unhealthy. A person might say wrong things while he's drunk. It's not nice. He might not conduct himself with the proper dignity that's fit for a Talmid Chacham. So if he is asked by the members of the party at the feast, at the meal of Purim, do you know the difference between Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai? He's allowed to say, I do not. In other words, I have already reached the point of intoxication that I'm required to, by law, so that he should not be offered any additional wine, be able to keep himself sober, but yet to pretend that he has had enough so that they wouldn't offer any more. As we said, there's a second interpretation for the entire item. Deeper thought. The Gemara says that the Rabbanan, the rabbis, those who study Torah deeply, are accustomed to, it's their custom to tell an untruth about these three items. To understand this carefully, we say the rabbis who study Torah, Pirkei Avot, it says, there are two requirements for the study of Torah. One, it says, Heve gole lemkom Torah. Mishneh Pirkei Avot says that if you want to really succeed in the study of Torah, don't do it in your own home or close to your home. If you want to succeed, you have to leave home entirely. Go out into the distant places, a distant city, place that is strange. It's like galut, exile. There, when you're away from your home comforts, away from the items at home that could take up your mind, or you can become free from any other outside concerns, you can then concentrate freely on the study of Torah and succeed in becoming a learned person, Talmid Chacham. That's one requirement. Second requirement that says the path, the way of Torah is that Chaye Tzar Techye, you have to live a life of suffering, be willing to live a life of suffering. Al Ha'aretz Tishan, you should sleep on the ground and eat bread, eat very light food. Then if you make these sacrifices, then you'll be able to learn Torah. Now, how can you encourage students to go study Torah if you're going to tell them you have to leave the comforts of home and go sleep on the ground and go eat bread and water and live a life of suffering? So in order to encourage students to go and study Torah, these who have already studied Torah, they've already advanced themselves to become Talmidei Chachamim, then these rabbis are accustomed to telling this white lie, telling the untruth. When they are asked by those potential students, is it difficult? Is this learning difficult? The first item, the Sechta Gemara, is it very difficult? Does it tax your mind too much? Is it boring? They lie about it. They say, no, it's very simple learning. Actually, Gemara is the deepest type of learning possible. It does tax the mind. It requires deep concentration. A person cannot learn Torah, lahavdil, as he would reading a book. You can't relax when you want to learn Torah. It requires deep concentration. It's hard work. And in fact, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that Torah is called tushia, which means it weakens a person physically. One who indulges in the study of Torah actually taxes himself to a point where he becomes physically weak. Now, if they would tell this to a potential student, they would immediately discourage him. Why go to a place where you become weak physically? You tax your mind. It's not interesting. And it's too much of a sacrifice. So in this case, they are permitted to. They are accustomed to telling an untruth. These rabbis will say, the study of Torah, the study of Gemara is very simple. It's very enjoyable. Enjoyable, of course, it is. Deeply enjoyable to want to study Gemara. But it's also simple. It doesn't require too much effort. This way, they encourage the person to study. Second question, Puriya Abed. They ask him, what about this statement that you have to sleep on the floor, the ground? Did you sleep on the ground? And they say, no, Puriya, we slept on a very comfortable bed. So that too would draw the person, the student, to saying, well, I'm not going to sacrifice my comforts of home. I'll have a good place to sleep there. However, what about the host? What about the food? Did you have food there? It says in the Mishnah, you have to eat bread and water. Here again, they tell the untruth and say that the host was wonderful, the food is perfect, and the life was very enjoyable. Physical life was enjoyable too. This way, they are able to induce new potential students to study Torah. Therefore, in this case, it is permissible. These three items, the Gemara says, are permissible for the rabbis to tell untruths. Of course, there's another case where the Gemara says, Yivamot, that for the sake of peace, it is permissible too to change, to alter the true facts. But that's not a fourth item. Actually, these three items are included in that one single statement. All these are for the sake of keeping peace, not to hurt someone's feelings, to keep a serene attitude on the part of people. So these are included too when the Gemara says that mitzvah or mutar, it's mitzvah, is permissible to the shanut, tell an untruth, l'mana shalom, for the sake of peace. The Gemara says that a person who borrows a Sefer Torah from his friend, the Sefer Torah, of course, could include also a Sefer. He borrows a Chumash, a Gemara. The borrower is forbidden to lend this Sefer to a third party because it was lent to him, and he cannot give it to a third party without the permission of the owner. The Gemara asks, what is so special about a Sefer? There is a general rule that when you borrow anything, once a person borrows something, he is restricted. He's not allowed to let it out of his possession to give it to a third party, no matter what the item is. When the person does you a favor, lends you something, he lent it only to you and to no one else. You're not the master of that item. So you do not have any right whatsoever to give it or lend it to a third party at all. So why here does the Gemara single out the word Sefer Torah or Sefer? What's special about this? Why would I think this was not included in that law? Gemara answers, because I would be under the impression that when the person lends you a Sefer Torah, then it's not just lending you an item. It's an item with which you are performing a mitzvah. Now, when a person has something which is a mitzvah, and somebody else can borrow this and get a mitzvah by doing it, by using it, that person generally is happy. For example, if you find a pair of tefillin in a shul, you're allowed to borrow them without the consent, without the knowledge of the owner. when actually borrowing somebody's possession without his knowledge is considered stealing. That's the sin of stealing. Borrowing, not to keep, but just to borrow it to use it for a while without telling the owner you borrowed it, that is the law of stealing. But in the case of a mitzvah, that we say, as the Gemara says, that we take it for granted that the owner of this item is happy to have somebody else use it because his item is being used for the sake of a mitzvah. So here, the Gemara says, I would think, I'd be under the impression that if somebody lent someone a sefer or sefer Torah, he wouldn't mind if that person would lend it to someone else, because after all, mitzvah is being done with his property. Yet, here the Gemara notifies us, this law, that though a person is happy to have a mitzvah done with his property, it's only with his knowledge if he had lent it to somebody else. If he lends a sefer to someone else, that person is now restricted by the law of not lending it to a third party at all. The Gemara tells us, for the sake of information about health, that water itself is one of the healthiest beverages out. And this means cold water, doesn't have any foreign elements in it, any sweetening of any kind. This is a very healthy beverage. The body needs water because it's so necessary. Therefore, Hashem created this item in such abundance that the poorest person can get as much water as he needs. Unless a person is in dire circumstances in the desert. But ordinarily, in civilization, there is enough water to go to supply a person's needs for drinking purposes. That again, is because water is a vital life necessity, and it's one of the healthiest beverages that exist. This applies, too, to water that is cooked, like tea, for example. Hot water is also healthy. There is no vitamin that's destroyed in water when it's cooked. So cold water and hot water is healthy. But just as cold water and hot water are healthy, so too is lukewarm water completely unhealthy. It is so unhealthy that the Gemara says better to take water that's actually poisoned to a degree, I mean, a certain type of poison, where there's magic spell cast over it and so on, rather than to take lukewarm water, water that's neither cold nor hot. That water is very destructive, very harmful to the person's health. And this is only if it's in any type of a cup, except a cup of earthenware. If it's in a clay dish, earthenware dish, then the bad effects are removed through the use of this dish. Also, in the case of lukewarm water, if there's another element put inside, any other type of ingredient it's mixed with, like coffee or any other type of bean, then that too dispels the evil force, the harm of this lukewarm water. But lukewarm water in itself, even as a person should be very careful to avoid at all costs because of the tremendous harm that it could do. One of the mitzvot of the Torah is if you find an avedah, a lost article, the mitzvah to return it. This is one of the actual mitzvot in the Torah itself. It's forbidden to close your eyes to this item. You see an item lying on the ground, and you have a chance to return it to its owner. You close your eyes to it, just walk away, let somebody else do this job of returning it. There is a specific mitzvah that's been broken. A sin has been committed. Yemen says, though, there are certain times when the Torah permits a person to close his eyes to a lost article. Exceptional cases where a person may close his eyes, pretend he doesn't see it, or actually walk away from this lost article and not perform the mitzvah of returning this item. One of those cases, for example, is if there is a wallet lying in the cemetery, a wallet that's precious, big mitzvah to return it to its owner. person walking by outside of the cemetery sees this wallet, but that person is a Kohen. It is forbidden for a Kohen to walk on cemetery grounds. And therefore, this case, the Kodesh says this is an exceptional case where a person, the Kohen, seeing this lost article, may close his eyes to it, refuse to pick it up. Not just that he may, of course, he has to. He's forced to ignore it because he's not allowed to step on a cemetery even for the sake of performing the mitzvah of returning this lost article. The second case, too, where a person is permitted to ignore it, not that he is forced, he's permitted to ignore it. And this is, let's say, if it's an article that's very bulky and very a low type of item, it's carried, let's say, an ordinary sack, that it would not look good for a dignified person to carry through the streets. And this is an old man or a respected sage, an old rabbi, walks past and sees this, it would be very embarrassing for him, for his kavod, to carry this through the streets. The Torah allows him to ignore this article, walk by, not to pick it up. In addition to what you have a mitzvah, that if your friend is struggling in carrying something, it's a mitzvah to help them. Not just carrying, this means if he has to lift something on his shoulders, it's very heavy, then you have to help him put it on his shoulders. This applies to a person, or even to, as the Pasuk itself speaks about, the main item the Pasuk talks about is in the case of an animal. You see your friend is lifting an article onto the back of a mule, then you must go and help him to load the mule. Or if you see him unloading the mule, also you must go and help him to unload it. Now, in unloading, Atanzel explains this word, where it says that if you see a person whose mule is overly loaded, it's breaking the mule's back, mule cannot continue on, and the person, the owner, is sitting on his side, he can't take the load off, and it says you must go over to him and help him to unload this burden from the back of the mule. But it says imo, with the owner together. The owner cannot sit back and say, you have a mitzvah in the Torah to unload the mule, I'll wait here and you do it. It's only together with the owner that you do it. You've got to help him. He can't shirk the duty itself completely. I mean, the Tanzal says, this is brought to the Rizal, that the meaning here is kiterech chamor. If you see a mule loaded, overloaded, then have pity on him and help with him, with the owner, to take this burden off his back. Chamor means the body, the low part, the animal instinct of a person. You see your friend, a Jew, who's loaded with sins, with bad deeds, and you have a chance to bring him to teshuvah, to remove these sins from him, his bad acts. It's a mitzvah to make this person do tshuva by talking to him, helping him. But it must be imo with him. It requires his help. He must cooperate because alone you cannot do it. The Beit Hazal himself said to his students, as much as I can do for you, helping you to become tzaddikim, helping you to become balei teshuvah, I cannot do it without your help. If you refuse to cooperate, no tzaddik in the world can make a person become a balei teshuva. Person has to be willing to be helped out. But with his help, then there's a mitzvah to help unload. The Gemara says that Rabbi Ishmael, Rabbi Yossi, was once going along the road, that he saw a person who had a heavy load, and this person was standing there resting. He had taken the load off his shoulders, a load of wood. He'd taken this load of wood off his shoulders, placed it on the ground to rest. As Rabbi Ishmael came by, this man said to Rabbi Ishmael, you have a mitzvah before you. Help me to load this wood onto my shoulders. So Rabbi Ishmael was an old rabbi. To go start picking up a load of wood, that's not his type of work. But he has a mitzvah. So he said to this man, How much does this load of wood cost? So he said it cost half a zuz, about half a dollar. Ishmael said to him, fine, I'll buy it for you. Here's a half a dollar. Now you're free. He bought this load of wood, and Ishmael said, okay, I now make it hefker. Hefker means I don't want it. I make it ownerless. I declare this ownerless, and that's it. He's about to walk away. This man grabbed the load of wood and said, it's hefker. Now it's mine. It's mine. I can't pick it up. He said to Ishmael, help me load this wood on my shoulders. Ishmael said, it cost a half a dollar. Here's a half a dollar again. The man took it, and Ishmael said, I now declare this hefker. The man rushed forward. He said, I make this hefker. It's mine. I make it hefker ownerless, free for everybody in the world but you. It's my wood. I can declare it as I wish. So you're not included in this. Anybody who wants can take it except you. That's the conditions that I make this hefker. But this is how the great Tzaddikim used to act. Now, he had a full right, according to din, according to law, to ignore it, to walk away from this man. He wasn't required. His kavod was not required to help him load that wood on his back. But he went beyond the limits of the din, beyond the requirement of a din Torah. This, the Yemenite language, is called lifnim mishurat hadin. Shunat Adin means the line of law, the limit of law, the exact line of law in the Torah. If Nim means to go beyond that inside, better than the law requires, more than the Torah requires, and he went to that extent, this is the act of a tzaddik. At the same time, the Gemara says that the Torah itself advises and insists that there are many times when the Torah says, this is the law, but you are not supposed to follow the law as it says. You must show kindness, compassion, goodness of heart, and don't stick to the letter of the law. Do better than the law requires of you. For example, the Yemenis, as it comes to visiting the sick. Now, visiting the sick, that's a din. What's so special about doing better than it requires? The answer is that there's such a thing as ben gilo. Ben Gilo means a person who was born under the same stars as his friend. Two people born under the same stars, which means the same birthday, then if one of those two is sick, the second one comes to visit him, he removes 1/60th of that person's sickness. If he removes it means he takes it upon himself. He receives 1/60th of that sickness. A person would say, am I required to visit the sick if it means that I'm going to get sick too? That's not part of the requirement. And here we find this is to go beyond the law, not just to visit the sick, even if it means that you're going to be, receive part of that sickness, definitely, still performing its vert to that extent also. And therefore, the Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan says, what is the reason, the ultimate reason that Yerushalayim became destroyed? The first holy temple we know, because there was idol worship. Avodah Zarah. We can understand that. At the same time, the punishment for idol worship was only 70 years of Gelut, of exile, in Bavel. Then the Jews came back and built the second Beit HaMikdash. What's the reason that in the second Beit HaMikdash, the Yerushalayim became destroyed, and not just for 70 years of exile, it's a few thousand years of exile? What was the serious sin that made the decision come from heaven to destroy Yerushalayim for so long in Galut? The Mishmael says the reason is because they established their laws, al-din Torah, according to the din of the Torah, according to the law of the Torah. That's why it was destroyed, because they kept to the law of the Torah. The Yemena asks, what's wrong with keeping to the law of the Torah? The Yemena answers, because that means that they did not go beyond the limit of the law. They were very, very careful, very strict with the law. Person who watches the law carefully and says, I must give exactly this amount. I must give my aser 10%. If a poor person is dying and asks me for charity, the law says give 10% and no more. They're required to give more. Let the person die. That's an evil act on this person's part. You have to go beyond the requirement of the Torah, L'thnivi shurat adin, better than the law requires, to show more kindness even than the Torah requires of you. Because the people of Yerushalayim kept strictly to the law, therefore Yerushalayim was destroyed. Of course, Tosafot says, we also have a Gemara which states, same question, Gemara Yuma says, why was Yerushalayim destroyed in the second Beit HaMikdash? And the Gemara answers that because of Sinat Chinam, there was an unreasonable dislike, disharmony, disrespect among the Jews themselves. They were all religious. They were all good, law-abiding Jews. There was this unreasonable disrespect and dislike among themselves. They couldn't get along among themselves. There was no unity. This caused their destruction. But why do we say here that it was because they kept to the law of the Torah? The answer is that to go beyond the law of Torah means that if you have two people on trial, one charges the other in a case in court, then if we follow the din exactly, we must show that one is innocent, the other is guilty, or this person must pay the amount that he's being sued for. To go beyond the limit of the Torah means that let's compromise. Making a compromise, they show that they are friendly enough, there isn't that dislike, distrust, disharmony, and they're willing to go not to the strict letter of the Torah, but to accept the compromise. So that we say the strict letter of the law is the same, is synonymous with sinat chinam, with this dislike and disharmony. When there is this harmony and this assistance, this anxiety for one to help each other, that means they're going to go beyond the din of Torah if necessary. So both of these actually add up to the same thing. Now in addition, if we note the words carefully, the Mefarshim say, there's another interpretation to this word. And it says that they establish their dinim on the basis of the law of the Torah, din Torah. This means that a person, for example, is created with a yetzer hara. He has evil desires, and his mission in life is to overcome and control those desires. There are different types of major desires. A person is drawn, he's tempted to a point where somehow he just can't control himself, or he finds it very difficult. Now, the easy way out, a person that commits sins, is to give up this struggle, to surrender to the Yitzhara, and to indulge himself in these temptations. That's the easy way out, but of course, there is a penalty to pay for it later on. Person that goes through life with the Melchemet HaYetzer, battling the constant struggle against the Yetzer Hara, that's living a life of difficulty, but eventually there is an eternal reward for this. Now, there are some people who feel that no matter how difficult the struggle, their conscience does not allow them to break this law. Torah says this item is forbidden. You cannot steal, you cannot cheat your fellow Jew. As much as they are tempted, they feel that they could never allow themselves to actually break a law of Torah. So what do? Instead, they study deeply and they bend the law. They show, they find a heter, they find a permission in the law itself. They find a loophole in the law to fit their needs. They'll show that through the dinim, through the laws of the Torah, they'll be able to find a means of permitting them to commit these crimes. So what the wording here means is shehem, midu dinehem. They establish, they set up their laws, their customs, al din Torah. They did it with the permission of the din Torah. They distorted the laws of Torah to fit their desires, their wants. Which means this crime, abim migaleh panim b'Torah shlo k'halacha. They brought out laws of Torah that were not true because they wanted to be allowed to commit their sins, their vile crimes. And I got, by the way, too, in Pirkei Avot it says that a person who brings out, who reveals from the Torah things that do not say in the Torah, he brings out statements because he wants it to find permission to commit crimes. So he brings out false statements from the Torah. That person has no chelik in Olam Haba, the future world. And this we must state very emphatically and very clearly and with a 100% certainty that this applies to the scientists and philosophers who speak words of kefir. They preach pure atheism, and then these religious Jews, some of the religious Jews, when they are confronted with the fact that the Torah states differently, as let's say, for example, take a very explicit example, when science teaches that the earth revolves around the sun, they teach this statement, and they find in the Torah the exact opposite stated again and again in Pesukim, in the Gemara, in the Midrashim, in the Zohar Kadosh, all the Sifrei Kabbalah, and all the Sifrei Tzadikim, where it states very clearly that this Copernicus theory, Machshavo, is 100% against the fact, against Torah, against the word of Hashem. These people then turn to take the words of Torah and Chas Shalom distort them, try to fit the words of Torah to apply, to equal, not to refute the words of science. Instead of accepting the words of Torah's truth and distort instead the words of the scientists, disprove scientists, they try to twist Torah, to bring out from Torah words that are against the truth, against Hashem. Now, this is where the Shnei Pirkei Avot is a sin like that, is 100% kfirat, and the penalty for that is Ein lo chelek l'olam haba. That person cannot have any part in l'olam haba because he is destroying the very essence, the very basis of our emunah, chas v'shalom. So we should battle against their statements, especially when Rabbeinu Zal warned about this and said, close to Mashiach's coming, you'll have a lot of this battle between science and Torah. Ashrei, ashrei to those who remain steadfast and strong in their emunah. Do not fall, even if you see countless victims falling prey, casualties to this onslaught of science, of kefirah. Remain very strong, because ashrei lahem to those who remain solid in their emunah. Hebrew says we have certain cases where a person is forced to break, to go against a din, an actual law of the Torah. For example, we have one of the nesvot of the Ten Commandments, which says, Kabed et avicha ve'et imecha, honor, respect, obey your parents. What if a father said to a kohen, go visit a grave in a cemetery? This kohen is now confronted with two laws. One, a law of respect, obey a parent. Second, he also has a law in the Torah which says, do not become tameh. A kohen may not go to the cemetery to a grave to become tameh. Or if a father says to a son, there's a lost article in the street, do not bother to pick it up. We're busy. I want you to come with me now. Leave it for somebody else. There's a direct conflict between the two then. Well, much more so if a father says to a son, I want you to come with me on Shabbat. We have to travel somewheres. Break Shabbat because I tell you to break it. Therefore, it's a mitzvah. In this case, the Gemara says, there's a pasuk in the Torah which says, Ish imol yaviv tirau, each one of you is required to fear, to respect, to obey your parents. And in the same pasuk, in the second half of the sentence, is et shabto tai tishmoru, and each one of you is required to observe my Shabbat. Ani Hashem, I am Hashem. Even as why does the pasuk add the words I am Hashem? To state very clearly that here you may have two conflicting items. Respect for a parent. The same time a parent says, Tibi Mechalel Shabbat. I'm letting you know that I am Hashem. Whose Hashem am I? I am your Hashem, and I am also your parent's Hashem. So my mitzvah transcends, is more important than the mitzvah. My command is higher, a higher authority than the command of your parents, because they too must obey me. So it's equivalent to a private in the army who's being ordered by a superior officer by a lieutenant perform a certain deed, this is Lahabdil, and the general comes and tells the private to do something contrary to the lieutenant. Naturally, he must ignore the lieutenant's command and obey the general because the lieutenant, too, is subservient, subordinate to the general. Here, too, when the parent says go against Hashem, the person must obey Hashem's command, ignore the parents, because the parents are required by law to fulfill the command of Hashem also. Now, this is the simple translation of these words. And the Shulchan Aruch says this applies not only to major mitzvah, but even to the laws of Rabbanan. Even the lowest type, the smallest mitzvah that exists, too, is a command of Hashem. And therefore, if a parent tells a child to break any law at all, the child is incumbent upon the child to obey Hashem's command and not to fulfill the parent's command. Same time, the question arises, is this child being forced to show disrespect to a parent? What happens to the respect, the honor to a parent in this case?